Welcome to the Tall Poppies podcast. To find out more about our guests or the content of the program, including information about the musical excerpts, visit our website at tall-poppies.com. Brendan O'Shea welcoming you to this episode of Tall Poppies with dancer and choreographer Rhys Martin, who originates from the Australian city of Newcastle.
When I think of Australia, I think about how countries arrive at their understanding of national identity. What is the role of a national identity in relationship to being an international citizen? I think of Australia as a highly privileged, fortunate country materially, and geographically. It doesn't have 6 week long winters like we do here with grey skies. It's also, even more so than America, a place where models of international thinking, and I don't mean a kind of reactionary Marxist internationalism, but I mean sort of ways of thinking about how one places oneself in a world that is increasingly impossible to think of in national terms, what the role of Australia might be in playing in that situation.
It was back in 1975 when Rhys Martin graduated from the Sydney University. He initially studied literature and fine arts and began his career in the theatre with Sydney's pioneering underground company called One Extra Dance. Rhys encountered many of the leading figures of the Australian dance scene at that time and travelled to work in Britain for a short period, subsequently to Germany, where he auditioned for the legendary choreographer Pina Bausch.
Pina always had Australian dancers in the company, yeah. Meryl Tankard, Joanne Endicott. I think partly because Australian dancers in some ways are not as restricted about what they're prepared to do and what they're prepared to try. Joanne, or Meryl, a very strong ballet background, still were completely open to exploring what that training in their body could do in other ways in the theatrical context, whatever that is, Australian quality. I suppose the Australian quality was the openness and then the curiosity and the lack of a kind of lobby mentality about promoting one or the other kind of performance. So I think Australians are very happy to move, and it's an Anglo-Saxon thing, but it's particularly Australian quality, perhaps, to be able to say, okay, I can try this and I can try that and whatever works, to be open to the new, to being persuaded that there are other things and not to go down those lines of serious or so-called entertainment theatre or performance or painting for there, but simply to see what's the task at hand and to get pleasure and satisfaction from applying oneself to that situation without feeling that one's betraying a tradition of 500 years of, you know, sort of like music history or European history or whatever.
In 1981, Rhys moved to Germany to join one of the country's most prestigious performance companies, the Reinhild Hofmann's Dance Theatre Ensemble. They performed regularly in the city of Bremen and at the Bochumer Schauspielhaus and also toured internationally. Since 1986, Rhys has worked as a freelance producer, director and choreographer of dance, opera, film and theatre. He's created work for the renowned contemporary music group Ensemble Moderne and collaborated for several theatre productions with the well-known Sydney-based composer Eleanor Katz-Czernin. Well, today Rhys Martin is professor of dance and choreography at Berlin's University of the Arts and has established the new Intercity Centre for Dance Berlin, where he now leads the contemporary Master of Arts in Solo Dance authorship. Indeed, it was in the midst of a busy teaching day at Berlin's University of the Arts that Rhys Martin sat down to talk with me. Rhys Martin, thank you very much for finding some time, and thank you very much for coming on the podcast. Great to meet you. I'm wondering what that term Tall Poppies means to you and what you've thought about it over the years.
Well, it seemed to bring me back to Australia. The Tall Poppy Syndrome, is that what you're talking about?
Exactly.
Sort of big head. What else is associated? Tall poppies. Past, because it's sort of for idiomatic terms, but tall poppies is sort of like get your head kind of sorted out. Don't sort of try and be more than anybody else. It's kind of that, especially in Australia, basic democratic kind of egalitarian society was always, especially I grew up in a town called Newcastle, where it was very important the kind of that nobody really differentiated themselves particularly from the others. And there was, on the one hand, a kind of feeling of solidarity and we're all the same, but also a large intolerance to anything that was not, could be identified as what we do in an industrial seaside town and on the east coast of Australia. So surf and play football.
Been a time in your time away now where it's not been a positive thing to be an Australian?
Actually, in comparison to my American friends, hardly ever. But certainly when it gets to anything close to the conversation around Indigenous culture, then even though I don't feel personally responsible for this culture, I certainly feel that that's something that we, if I can use that term, that we still need to sort out. And definitely speaking, that the whole question about colonial occupation of other cultures is something that it makes me, in an Australian, my Australian identity, and I would say that I have lots of identities, but that Australian identity, I feel uncomfortable about because I'm not doing enough about it.
One of the things I noticed right from the very beginning is that you, in your biography, you speak about studying fine art and literature,
but
no mention of dance, yet you're a dancer and choreographer, and that's what you came to Europe as. Tell us about those early days and how that all came about, where you trained, and you know, because you were involved in a couple of very interesting things happening there in Sydney back in the 70s and 80s.
Yeah, I mean, dance for me at Newcastle was going to, I think it was called Bus Stop Discotheque on Saturday night and make sure you didn't get your head beaten in. I actually liked not only the social side of it, of meeting, in my case, the opposite sex, but also I actually liked the act of dancing. But it was, in Newcastle in those days, not really a widely accepted practice. Like I said, sport, football, we used to play Australian rules. I was actually not very good, but a high board diver. So that was the closest I got to dance in that form, and then dance and music was social. So I didn't actually encounter dance at all in my life until I actually went to university in Sydney, and one of my early girlfriends was a part-time dancer. I mean, she was studying together, but she actually introduced me to this thing called modern dance that I'd never heard of. I knew roughly what ballet was and never had any real interest to be involved in that. But with Elizabeth was, at that time, had studied dance as a school subject at Fort Street Girls High School in Sydney in those days, with quite a wonderful character called Coralie Hinckley. And she used to work for a lady called Margaret Barr, or perform for Margaret Barr, which is a kind of part of Australian dance history, on Saturdays, you know, like, so you used to go along there and do classes. And then she dragged me. Now, I went with curiosity to see a performance. I think it was at the Teachers Federation House in Sussex Street in Sydney, which has long disappeared, I think. And said, let's have a look at this performance. And I didn't know what was going on. I didn't understand, and I was thought it very strange. But at the time, I was doing an academic program at university, but trying to be a painter. So I thought I could be a painter. I was interested, but sort of autodidactic kind of painter. Went down and saw this staging and had lots of questions about why everybody was making so much noise on stage. It didn't seem to be what dance had to do and what was actually happening here. There was no kind of clear narrative thread. So that was the beginning. But in actual fact, I went back to visual arts and studying and decided, you know, that was something my girlfriend did. And only later when we went to Europe together and she introduced me to a guy called Kay Tai Chan, who's kind of an important figure in the sort of the second half of the 20th century in Sydney in contemporary dance and modern dance, who was performing at a place called Oval Theatre. And I said, yeah, how are you? That's fine. And a year later, after doing what Australians do, travelling home, it took me about 14 months to get overland back to Oz. I decided by that time I needed to do something physical. And I did yoga once a week. And the relationship with Liz had sort of finished, but I found that Kay Tai Chan was teaching at Stanley Palmer's Cultural Palace in Sydney. It was on the corner of Stanley and Palmer Street, and it was a desanctified, beautiful sandstone building. I'm sure it's still there. And it was a culture centre in the red light area of Darlinghurst. So I taught ceramics there as part of the culture centre, but also went Tuesdays and Thursdays to beginner's dance class. I never studied dance in that form. I was actually, within 4 weeks of doing those classes, I was on stage up a ladder waving my hands around in a light, because there was such a shortage of men in that business, in alternative fringe dance in Sydney in those days. This is like late 70s.
And then, of course, Europe in 81, right? Germany's always had quite a number of big names as far as contemporary dance goes. Pina Bausch, we have to think about, and, of course, Forsyth and various other people in that respect, probably already working well and truly in the 80s. And you yourself then worked in Bochum and Bremen, right, with Reinhild Hoffmann, right?
That's right, yeah.
How did that come about?
Well, a little bit the same, also through another girlfriend of mine, actually. I have a lot to thank the girls for. The only thing I sort of really knew about Germany before I left Oz, after working for 3 years in underground experimental theatre after sort of university, was the Bauhaus, Oskar Schlemmer, but more from the point of view of fine arts perspective. We actually went to London with one extra, organised that in a completely mad foray, taking 14 to 15 people to London without a theatre, with our costumes, and just turning up and say, can we perform here? Which was sort of just basically happened because Kate had a very thin connection to one of the people there that was involved in the dance scene, and we did get a season at The Place, which is quite an established theatre in London, so it was totally lucky, but we managed to do a double season there. And then the company in Kate went back, but I decided that it was such a low-budget activity being in a contemporary dancer that I couldn't afford to go back to Australia and get back to Europe. And I wanted to keep travelling. I wanted to do that. And I also thought whether I could exist outside this company called One Extra Dance. It was a very sort of company of very idiosyncratic individuals and practices, but I was wondering whether I could do this thing called dance with other people. And so I decided to stay, and the company went back, and I had a session freelancing in London for a while, and then I was for 6 months a seahorse and a pirate with a dance and education company in Ipswich. And at that time, Chrissy Parrott, who's quite an established Western Australian choreographer, said to me, she'd been over Europe, I should go over and check it out. You know, that was basically. And I'd heard of the name Pina Bausch, but I didn't really know very much about it, and I certainly didn't know the name Reinhold Hoffmann, but on my Christmas break, I hitchhiked over to Wuppertal and turned up in Wuppertal and said, can I audition? When I think about it now, what I know about now, it was pretty amazing what happened. I got to stay for a week, and I sort of, in the evenings after Wuppertal auditions, I sort of had one-to-one rehearsals with Pina that she couldn't really decide, and so didn't say no, but couldn't say yes. And before that, because I thought that was the most amazing thing I'd ever seen on stage and the logical extension of what I'd been doing in Sydney with Kaitai. But I had been in Bremen beforehand and met Reinhild and found out about the whole kind of, well, it began to find out, not find out, the whole tradition of German modern dance that goes back to Kurt Jors, Rudolf von Laban, and started to begin, that was my first entry into that. Pina couldn't decide, so I had a contract, Reinhold offered me a contract, with the promise that I would sort of work on my classical ballet technique, which was at that time very, very modest.
Well, that was going to be my question. I mean, you land in Germany and suddenly you're dancing for one of the most famous choreographers, auditioning for two of them, and you land with one. And actually, what sort of technique, what sort of ballet technique did you actually have? I mean, from what I can understand, you haven't had any lessons at all.
Well, no, that's not true, because it was a condition of the Australia Council for One Extra, after about 18 months, that we do ballet classes or they wouldn't fund us anymore. So so I ended up being, along with four or five of my colleagues, very atypical looking, at Valerie Tweedy's Academy of Australian Ballet in Central, the back of Central, surrounded by people half my size dressed in pink. And I had bells and bangles and beards and very, very long hair in those days. And most of us did that. It was a very strange mixture of meeting of the ballet world with this sort of strange, freaky, experimental dance people from One Extra. The connection was, and I'm very grateful at that time, to two people that worked with us. One was Valerie Tweedy, who in her ballet world looked like a very sort of severe ballet kind of figure, but was actually also someone who'd been over here, worked with Ballet Russe de Monte Carlo, who had been actually a kindred spirit in terms of not seeing the world as all in pink, but just to survive in Sydney in those days, that was the bread ticket. And her pal, Peggy Watson, I'm not sure if either of them in my life, But Peggy was also a very kind of stoic Scottish, someone that also went to see Grotowski performances. People from the ballet world that had a different connection to the performance world. And they had a soft spot for us and they took us in. So I actually did ballet classes, but this is going to be ironical for you because these ballet classes were, along with the Aboriginal Island Dance Company, which was then forming under a woman called Carol Johnson. So in Sydney, I can remember this, the St. James Hall in the mornings working with the Aboriginal Island dancers, doing Mother Graham classes twice a week and ballet classes twice a week. So that's, I kind of begin to know what a suspensorium is. I don't know if you know what that is. It's a dance belt. It's a very strange pair of underwear, that underpants you have to wear when you're a ballet dancer. And start to point my legs in that kind of way and start to think about what tendus are. So I'd actually got to London with a year and a half of that stuff behind me, and the rest was a bit of bullshit, really, bluffing.
I mean, indeed, encountering someone like Pina Bausch at that stage of her career, she was a pretty serious woman, a remarkable artist, rather renowned for her exactness in many ways and really also choosing unusual sorts of dances and things.
I think that's why she sort of actually even considered talking to me, because I said I'd send a letter, and I don't think that was true either, but I turned up and I was totally naive, and then she's got some of the best dancers in the world around at the time. No, I think it was because of that part of the work maybe that interested her. I'm a bit of a character, person on stage, less of a technician, and I think that maybe she gave me the benefit of the doubt there. But I went through some very, very exhausting hours with her doing Sacre de Printemps, which is a very demanding piece of dancing. Mm. And then she even sort of saying to me, why am I dancing like a rock and why am I so stiff? And at the time I was going, well, look, I'm doing the best I can. But when I think about it now, that she even gave me the time of day, even after one day, I was very grateful for this experience. So I didn't get the job, but I did certainly have this very fantastic experience with the kind of very laconic Pina Bausch, a personality, well, not very transparent personality, but someone who was had a great aura and presence. And certainly at the time when I saw the work, because while I was there, I saw this work and I was completely knocked out about what dance could be, as opposed to what I did come
it's
to
a
expect.
A very, very, very famous choreography of hers as well, isn't it?
Well, Sacre is the kind of, it's the choreography that for some people legitimized the whole dance entry into what has become a transdisciplinary kind of performance, Multi-Gesamtkunstwerke. With Sacre, it was always possible to demonstrate that the people who were dancing for Pina and Pina's work was highly skilled, technical, physical work. Because especially in the 80s, I mean, later she came back to dance or movement and music, but in the 80s especially, the whole question of what do I do on stage as a dancer was completely in the front of everybody's attention, and Pina's and her company were seriously questioning the kind of received notion of what a dancer should be as an object of desire or of a performance desire. And as you probably know, made the big break for theatre that the experience of the performer became the subject of the performance.
Talking to Barry Kosky, one of the things that he says that we Australians seem to be able to export a lot of are dancers. Do you think that the dancers that come out of Australia these days getting the sort of background and the preparation that they need for careers elsewhere?
Well, what I've heard, I mean, just if we go back to just Pina, I mean, Pina always had Australian dancers in the company. Indeed. And Meryl Tankard, Joanne Endicott, and yet now Julie. I think partly because Australian dancers in some ways are not as restricted about what they're prepared to do, what they're prepared to try, even if and often like Joanne or Meryl, a very strong ballet background, still were completely open to exploring what that training in their body could do in other ways in the theatrical context. And I think at the time, coming out of the 70s, well, there are lots of different of things happening in Australia in the 70s. I mean, the Australian Ballet is kind of not that old by that stage. I think it's, if I've got my history right, it's 20 years since Borovansky started the Australian Ballet in the 50s. So the kind of identity for Australian dancers to be in the ballet world, but there was not so much happening in the in a professional context in the non-ballet world. But then the arrival of Jonathan Taylor in Adelaide, in Australian Dance Theatre, started to open up the idea of contemporary, well, not, let's be careful about this term, contemporary is it's terms. All right, let's modern, a modern dance or contemporary modern dance, there's, it's a bit of a minefield, this terminology, but came to Australia and the Australian Dance Theatre also started to open up to contemporary choreographers at the time who were working outside of ballet aesthetic but still using the technique. So there's people like Glenn Tetley and Christopher Bruce from London who are moving away from the traditional ballet aesthetic of celebrating the body in a very strict canon of steps and music. Having said that, of course, there are always exceptions, and Australian Ballet also perform works by neoclassical choreographers. Mm. But on the other hand, the people that were challenging the whole notion of what dance could be in, other than ballet, were also often in the wings at that time in the 70s. I think that's changed quite a bit, but One Extra was emerging in that, but there were also a bunch of people called the Dance Exchanges, Russell Dumas, who's still, I think, in Sydney, but Eva Karsak, who teaches now to this day here in Europe, who were then opening up to a completely different world, and that's the Judson Church, American modern dance, decided to challenge even the modern coryphean or the more the established modern heroes of Martha Graham and Doris Humphrey, and paradigm change that happened in dance in the mid, especially in America, in the middle of the 20th century, is to move from representation to presence. So John Cage, Cunningham, not so much what the body was standing for, representing, but what the body could do, and finding out and exploring and leaving things open to chance. So that was quite, and still is, a big difference to what was happening here in Germany in that context, or in relationship to Pina Bausch. There was, of course, a lot of people here interested in bringing that American tradition also to the continent, but there was a very strong tradition in Essen, in Wuppertal, of German expressionist modern that had kind of been truncated in the 30s in the Second World War, but it had been, along with America, one of the centers of innovation and experiment in dance, in international dance. Got put to sleep through the National Socialists and then was revived when Kurt Jooss, who had been given a home in Darton College in England, came back and to Essen. And Pina Bausch was one of his most important students at that time. Right. So that's where the kind of threads kind of connect. And there are connections, of course, always have been connections, transatlantic connections, because these things are never black and white. But let's say moving from the kind of interest in the body as an art object in America that's becoming an art object and what can it do, to an object of social and psychological inquiry. Pina always said she's not interested so much in the movement of the body as what moves the people that are moving. So what's how are they motivated? What's driving those kind of movements? Yeah.
Very famous quote, of course, and that's a very interesting aspect. Of course, from the beginning with you, though, it's been choreography and dance and in directing as well. You know, you haven't really just stayed in one particular area. This already says to me that perhaps you think even the description of dance doesn't sufficiently cover what a performer should be doing, that it's somehow much bigger than that, because you've been involved in the whole process right from the beginning, right?
Yeah, well, I mean, when I entered into it, I didn't know very much at all. And like I say, coming from a visual arts, academic visual arts background, had that more of that kind of tradition behind me, or tradition, or that kind of cultural tradition, European, Western art, and the movement into the modern. But I was very impressed by two people in Australia at that time, if I can just go back to that, to say. One was a guy called Donald Brook, who was lecturing in modern art at Sydney University. As a beginning student, I was totally thrown into panic because I didn't understand one of the lectures, the first four lectures that he gave. It was about aesthetics and the flight from the object, and I had absolutely no idea what that had to do with the kind of historical approach that I'd done in a couple of years of school, visual arts, art history, but began to actually open me up to a whole understanding of the function of art and art practice in relationship to social and political movements and as an aesthetic or a philosophical concept in itself. The other one was a guy called Ken Unsworth, who was my sculpture teacher at the Sydney Teacher College, who refused to teach any technique, but said, if you've got any questions, come and see me and we can talk about it. So the epistemological idea of finding out what you are interested in always interested me as an artistic practice. So never to want to repeat a kind of cultural accepted skill. I've done that. I had a lot of fun doing that. I've sort of learned to do the best of my ability, which is not particularly great, but let's say to take on board techniques like Graham technique, ballet, right down to these days, hip-hop and street dancing, but never was so much interested in the perfection of those techniques on their own terms, but what they could bring me in terms of opening up areas of inquiry about ways to ask the world why the world is like it is and how it can be. So if that's not too opaque, I sort of, let's say... Then when I got into dance, that was suddenly I sort of combined this need to enjoy the physical challenge of encountering the world as a body, along with the cognitive challenges of trying to say what can I do with this body that I think is interesting or challenging, and I suppose that's what I'm doing here now institutionally with my students. So it's a long curve, but like 35 years ago, I started as a performer and a maker, and asking myself what this live presence, this physicality, as opposed to textual theatre or text-based theatre, which I was at the time not very convinced by, that as an interesting medium for these kind of artistic questions. With all due respect to the colleagues in repertory theatres. So I think I was, in that sense, never satisfied just to go one way with one discipline, and that's a positive thing, but it's also a restriction because you're a jack of all trades and master of none.
How easy was it for you establishing yourself as an Australian artist here in Germany in the way that you did back in the 80s?
That, whatever that is, Australian quality. I suppose the Australian quality was the openness and then the curiosity and the lack of a kind of lobby mentality about promoting one or the other kind of performance. So I think Australians are very happy to move, and it's an Anglo-Saxon thing, but it's particularly Australian quality, perhaps, to be able to say, okay, I can try this and I can try that, and whatever works, to be open to the new, to being persuaded that there are other things, and not to go down those lines of serious or so-called entertainment theatre or performance or painting for there, but simply to see what's the task at hand and to get pleasure and satisfaction from applying oneself to that situation. Without feeling that one's betraying a tradition of 500 years of, like music history or European history or whatever. As you know, that's a debate that's been going on in Australia since actually the Australian Impressionists and the Angry Penguins were writing and trying to decide what is there an Australian art form or not Australian art form, with Norman Lindsay, I think it was, and back in those days, 150 years ago. But now that's still in the spirit. So for me too, I say at that point, even though it may not sound like anymore, I came here with an Australian accent and I had that kind of cheek or openness to turn up in Wuppertal and say, give me a go, without having to bring out my qualifications or whichever, And I think that surprises people here. And the Germans quite, what's the English word for entwaffnet? They're disarmed a little bit by the fact that anybody could even pretend or claim to want to do this, and because for them, you have to be able to say, I've been studying for 12 years in this academy, that academy, and I think Australians, we have, and I'm not saying all Australians are like this, not at all, Australians have highly qualified, skilled people, but there is the chance to come in from the side just because we think we can, just because if you have a go, you have a go, and if you don't, it sort of doesn't work. But you don't have to feel like that your whole cultural, Eurocentric kind of approach to life will then dismiss you from ever doing anything again.
Indeed. And, of course, it is now Professor Rhys Martin. You are actually now an educator and in a very interesting and very unique institution here in Berlin. Berlin's been your home for a long time. I was able to witness today, when I come to a dance academy, I thought I was going to be witnessing dance classes, but it was something actually quite different. And it was a group of young students who were discussing their final assessment program, what they're actually doing. For me, you seem to have been able to move all of these ideas of yours over to the point of actually presenting a platform here for these young artists. Now, even the title of the course that you're teaching here, Solo Dance and Authorship, is actually quite unique in many ways. Can you tell me about that?
Yeah, I think it's the only one, because I've been fighting for that title for about 12 or 13 years, ever since I started doing this. In the beginning, I was a little bit naive. I didn't really realize what kind of trouble I was getting into by calling the course this. It was, for me, combining a bunch of interests, like you just said. I mean, I also, as far as possible, I've been lucky enough to be able to be involved in lots of kinds of levels of theatre, so directing mainstream theatre, I've been involved in film, musicals, directing plays, etc.
And you've, of course, worked with major German ensembles, like the Berlin Philharmonic is one, and, of course, Ensemble Moderne.
Yeah, so that's been very lucky, and to be able to sort of challenge the fine platforms that are also, I think, each time are looking for other ways of doing something. So that's, if I say that's what I'm basically interested in, other ways. At the same time, celebrating what has been done before. It's not that I've sort of completely tabula rasa and that's all rubbish that's happened before, because I also, as you probably know, I also teach in musical theatre, which is kind of traditionally the arch enemy of what I'm doing here, conceptual experimental performance. But I've just this very wide interest in embracing all possible platforms that may are involved in asking us in different ways about what life can, how we can see life. And it's kind of philosophical practice, if you like, through practice, through movement and thinking. So what happened about 12 years ago, there was, or 13 years ago now, because we're celebrating, there was the federal government announced, suddenly released a lot of funds to improve the position of dance in Germany as being perceived the poorest relative in the arts. And this is true. Dancers are, even in state theatres, much better off than the rest of the world, where they don't earn very much money at all. They have 13-month contracts here, but they're pretty much the lowest paid in the hierarchy of theatre. And to improve the lobby of those dancers to be able to become articulate about what it is they're actually doing, when in actual fact so many of them just very, very occupied, because it's a very, very demanding job to do, how to get their bodies to do what they want them to do. So then to be able to get into, have the distance and the age to be able to sort of conceptualize and formulate their ideas has never been a priority in conservatory education. So one of the things here I thought we needed, and the solo thing is, I thought, the lowest common denominator that could be financed and this kind of performance interrogation, was to ask people to think about what it is they do themselves on stage, what they're responsible for, how did they get to where they're going, what are they thinking, and how can they communicate those thoughts through what they do on stage or in installations or in the gallery, but also in other forms. So that it's not just that's my work and, you know, take it or leave it, but to be able to think about this as a practice of social sharing information outside the mercantile, outside the applied, not really knowing what it's good for, but simply believing in that it is actually has value in itself, the fact that we can just look and ask ourselves how else and what else can be done.
Very, very interesting, of course. How much of this has to do with the fact that you come from Australia and this Australian background of yours and all of those qualities and characteristics that you were talking about before? In other words, you're presenting something here in Germany, and I'm wondering, would this be possible in any other country?
Perhaps it's possible. What's certainly possible here is that we can get institutional support for this, you know. Whether that's possible in other countries, it may be. It depends on what kind of argument you can present. And let's be clear about this. The current sort of attitude in German cultural politics makes it possible to set up courses that, as in direct correspondence or comparison to British academia at the moment, that doesn't have a price tag on it. So the German education system is incredibly generous in welcoming other people from other cultures and countries, as long as along with its own. And I must say, we have more international students than German students, but I've never had a problem from politicians or government that is in any way a problem, and I can imagine that would be a problem in many other countries. What about our students? but also to give them to be able to resource a course that would cost actually, if you were buying it, like in Britain. Well, my daughter's now doing a MA in Britain in the National Film Television School, and it's costing her 23,000 euros just for the fees. Arguably, she's going into a business where she can earn that money back. In contemporary dance, there is no chance. Or let's say, that won't be that nihilistic, but there's very little chance that you will be able to finance a lifestyle with this kind of very, very edgy, experimental, very difficult to put a sort of value on it, a product value, what it's good for. It's not entertainment. It is an academic research through the body. And of itself, I think, and I've defended this many times, valuable, not just to the people who are doing it, but to the community that allows that kind of thinking to go on. But in other countries, to get resources to do that, with people asking you, yes, but what do they earn and what are the jobs do they do and how will they earn? I think this one of the great advantages of the cultural landscape in Germany is that that is not immediately the question. It's not a question. But the very fact that we can resource these kind of programs speaks for still a very liberal, open-minded political society that sees value in cultural practice.
Let's look at the international aspect a little bit, because that class that I visited this afternoon, we had somebody from Bolivia, we had somebody from Poland, we had somebody from Ghana, we had somebody from Argentina. These were all students in your class. This remarkable sort of melting pot of people with such diverse cultural backgrounds coming together.
Contemporary dance is pretty nomadic international world. It's not a wealthy world, but it's a highly mobile world. There are lots of residencies. There's lots of solidarity. There's a kind of a feeling, because it's also very youthful, because the body is still a big part of this practice. So having a body that works and does things generally means that a lot of younger people, from my perspective, younger people, are busy with this art form. And not so many older people. They have a great resilience to be able to not demand all the material comforts that maybe other artists who are in more mature years. There's a kind of buzz in being a nomad, prepared to sleep here and there and travel at short term. And it's part of the artistic identity. So having said that, here at the HZT, the International University for Dance, all the programs have got a high international component. Perhaps what with SODA or Solo Dance Authorship is that because of this, the name that I sort of spent a lot of time dealing with was to how can I offer both a practice that can be done cheaply or sort of feasibly. You don't need a company of dancers every time you do a work. Let's say it's cited in the actual, the performer is the author, is the maker. And I've done this kind of work myself, so I know how difficult it is to be that inside and outside person, that to do it and still call it dance without moving into performance, because performance is a big term now in visual and the theatre arts. But It would be a shame to lose the kind of cognitive and theoretical side of that performance and just say the dancers are the ones that move to music. It's just not true. And the authorship is the whole question of who does this stuff belong to, where is it, taps into a whole kind of not only local but international research agenda, post-colonialism, appropriation, queer theory. So what was essentially an attempt at the beginning just to look at the difficulty of what it is to make performance by yourself. We've emerged into this whole discursive arena which covers philosophy, sociology, media theory, and an absolutely exploding area of inquiry that's now in the arts on a one-to-one basis, in not just talking about the arts, but actually performing within the arts these ideas. How are they? How can they be used? So we're here busy with names from philosophy, Foucault, literary theatre, psychoanalysis, Lacan. These are really strong influences in the making of dance. And the fact that we can offer this in English means it makes it incredibly accessible to an international type of performer that is busy with this kind of ideas and is looking for, firstly, company, because doing it by themselves is a very lonely business, and these are individuals that are isolated in some ways in their own kind of communities. To be able to come here and at the same time not encounter that everybody's doing the same stuff, but in actual fact, we look to try and find people who are different to each other, but still have the claim that they have to be able to work together and to find levels of communication. So what you saw today was an attempt for people who would normally not talk to people who have those kind of ideas outside themselves, attempting to share the difficulty, the common difficulty of saying, what can I say about my work? And to be able to be not defensive about that, to offer it to a community who have a similar interest and also being in a sympathetic and protective environment, being able to find out and navigate what it is that can be said about they do in order to better understand what they do themselves, but also to educate their audiences and to be able to not say, well, you don't understand me or you understand me, but to be able to articulate not only in the work, but in how they talk about the work. And this is a big shift in arts practice anyway, especially in the dance, contemporary dance world, to move from the object of observation, of representation, into an active interaction with the audience in a dialogue about what it is art is and what can do and what can the body do and what can the performance do and what is choreography and what is dance. We don't offer a prescriptive idea of what dance is, not that there's any problem with that, but we actually ask people to come from lots of different environments, cultural, economic, social, aesthetic, and tell us or tell the community through us what they think dance is. And I think that's much more interesting. That's basically what I've been interested in since Stanley Palmer's Cultural Palace back there in Sydney in the late 70s. Yeah.
This work that you're doing and also seeing what's happening in Australia, do you sometimes think that perhaps something like what you're doing here might help with a certain number of problems that Australia faces in that way?
Oh, wow. That's interesting. I haven't really thought. My connection with Oz, it's an interesting one because I've done a few works there. In fact, 3 or 4 years ago, I just did a work with a bunch of young people in Sydney. We showed it at the Sydney Art Gallery. But I'm actually out of the loop in the artistic world there. I have been actually for 30 years, I suppose. I did a piece called Dinosaur in Sydney exactly 32 years ago. This is the age of my oldest daughter, so I can remember that one. But since then, I've done not a few projects, but I've never been part of the continuous situation. The cards haven't gone that way where I've been managed to maintain an ongoing artistic relationship. So, but what I do is, because I have at least 4 siblings that are still there, my mother, almost 90, is also in Australia. And so going back there and walking around the back suburbs of Adelaide, a very sort of strange experience in some ways with the galahs and the cockatoos and everybody's spring gardens looking wonderful. And when you meet someone in the street, they say, it's a bit hot today, isn't it? And after being in Europe where people look away or have sort of, and I've got used to that too, of being the whole notion of private space, an entirely different one. That was interesting because that was a totally non-professional visit. I did actually go to, but through private family, I went to a performance of students in the Adelaide Arts Academy, or a bunch of movement students. And I thought they were great. I had a very sort of sense of contemporary issues about their political demands. They're still making pieces in some cases about the boys at the Barbie, that kind of Australian cultural critical stuff that's been going on for about 40, 50 years. I thought that subject matter was perhaps a little stale. And I was wondering, what are the issues? What are political issues about immigration? Though that was, I have to say, that was also a very strong element of these young people's. It was a presentation of a class. It wasn't a show in a sense. So your question about how this kind of practice that I do here could influence there, I tried to keep abreast of what's actually happening, but I noticed that I haven't voted for many years because I wouldn't presume to do that now, because I'm here. I know a lot more about German politics, even though I can't vote here, and British politics than I do about Australian politics. But I'm aware of Manus Island and the things that are happening there. I'm aware of the Barrier Reef and of the plans there for coal exploitation. It's very frustrating, and occasionally I send moralistic letters to my Facebook account there. Why aren't we doing anything about this? What's going on? But in actual fact, I don't feel like I'm in a position from here to be able to in any way make recommendations for something that I'm no longer really informed of all the facts. But I do try and keep up. Whether what we're doing here can do with that, well, yeah, sure. I keep on saying that what we are doing here is not just an aesthetic practice, it's a social practice. And I think what the class is trying to do with its internationalism is to be able to recognize the value of other cultures and other ways of seeing at the world, and actually put people together to actually find ways of how to agree, how to work together, how to live together, and how to take responsibility for one's own sense of identity without losing that, at the same time to be able to embrace alterity or difference. So I think artistic practice in any way, a lot of it does that, but I would say that in this case, and my experience in the last 10 years has been that I think that it's valuable. Maybe it's a pretty high-end ivory tower version of it, but it's not without ripples. We all produce ripples. So the kind of behavior that we practice here amongst ourselves, I would maintain ripples out to our other relationships with other people and other contexts. And without being deliberately, you know, don't make a deliberate attempt to put three Syrians in the class, because that's what's happening at the moment. We have a lot of applications from people from those kind of places, Iran. I get a lot of applications from Iran, and try not to be swayed by the fact of we have to give these people a kind of political asylum. We only take them if we think the artistic practice is going to be helpful for everybody involved, and not because they're in a socially difficult position or a politically difficult position. So yes, I think it can be valuable, but I wouldn't presume to say that this is in any way kind of what Australia needs. You know?
Rhys Martin, when do you feel Australian the most?
I know I'm an Australian when I mumble, people always tell me what, or I know Australians know I'm an Australian when occasionally my vowels bend, maybe after a glass or two of wine, and realize, oh, I do have an accent of my own, even though everybody tells me now that I have a German accent when I go back to Oz sometimes. I know when I'm Australian when I have a fairly healthy disrespect for anything authoritarian or any rules and regulations. And I know I'm Australian when I get home at night and open the fridge and need a beer.
Dancer and choreographer Rhys Martin there. Don't forget, if you'd like to find out more about the Tall Poppies series, then do drop by our website. You'll find it at tall-poppies.com. You can also drop us an email to the address info@tall-poppies.com. That's info@tall-poppies.com. Sound engineer Thanos Karakantas helped put together this episode, which was produced in Berlin and made possible through the support of the Australian Embassy in Berlin. I'm Brendan O'Shea. It was nice to have you with us today, and I look forward to welcoming you again very soon.